This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Urban Political podcast. I'm Michael Byrne, lecturer at University College Dublin. Today, we'll explore the political economy of the private rental sector and associated forms of housing injustice, as well as the question of tenant politics. This episode brings together the authors of four recent books dealing directly with these issues. We have Tracy Rosenthal, author with Leonardo Vilches of Abolish Rent, How Tenants Can End the Housing Crisis. Tracy is a writer and an organizer based in the US and was a founding member of the LA Tenants Union. Jacob Stringer is the author of the book Renters Unite, How Tenants Unions Are Fighting the Housing Crisis. Jacob is a researcher, campaigner, and longtime organizer engaged in the tenants' rights movement. And we have Jaime Palomera, author of El Secuestro de la Vivienda, ¿Por qué es tan difícil tener casa y cómo esto puede romper la sociedad? Jaime's book is not available in English, unfortunately, but the title translates to something like The Kidnapping of Housing. Jaime is a housing scholar activist who works with the IDRA Research Collective in Barcelona and was previously a spokesperson for the Barcelona Tenants Union. And finally, myself, Michael Byrne, author of Beyond Generation Rent, Political Economy, Inequality and the Private Rental Sector. And as mentioned, I'm a lecturer in political economy and a housing researcher at University College Dublin. Hi, everyone. So look, let's get straight into thinking about the political economy of housing and the private rental sector. So Tracy, I might go to you first, if I may. Your book critiques the landlord-tenant relationship. How do you think we should understand that relationship?
Part of what the intervention that we wanted to make in the book Abolish Rent was really coming to an analysis that is shaped by tenants' actual experience of this relationship of rent and like what it is that we're doing when we pay rent every month. I think that the reframe that we wanted to make that was really grounded in tenants' experience was, you know, what do we call a payment for a basic human need, right? Like it's a human need to have housing. And if you don't own housing, then you have to pay for it, right? Like what do we call a payment like that? It's a fine. It's effectively like rent is effectively a fine for a human need. Moreover, what do we call a payment that is made to a small population that is hoarding a resource that other human beings need access to, right? That's a tribute. When we think about why our landlords own our housing, they don't own our housing because they are better than us, smarter than us, or more hardworking than us. They own our housing because they or their parents or their parents' parents had more money than us, and they took that money and they used it to buy up the places where human beings can live, and they charge us to access that, right? So like, again, that relationship is one of tribute. I think we also talk about rent as a trap, right? Because as we continue to make these tribute payments, we couldn't possibly ever save enough money to exit that relationship and then, you know, start exploiting other people in that same way. And then finally, I think also we are wanted to be very clear about the role of state violence in maintaining this relationship, full stop. When we think about what rent is, when we know that if we don't pay it, our landlords can call on agents of state violence to throw us out of our homes using physical force and then arrest us, right? If we find ourselves outdoors because it's effectively criminalized to live outside, to be without housing. That what, you know, a payment that is made on the edge of a barrel of a gun, that is a ransom, right? So like, this is a relationship of ransom. So just thinking about the way that this relationship is fundamentally one of exploitation and domination, and we've built the system of housing, it's effectively illegal to not be exploited by a landlord. Like, it is a crime to not be exploited by a landlord in our society. So thinking about the ways that, yeah, these relationships of exploitation and domination are like fundamental to this relationship. And that is kind of the, you know, the intervention that is a theoretical intervention, but it's actually just trying to consider what the experience, the day-to-day experience of tenancy is like for people.
That's really interesting, Tracy. And I think that point about, because one of the points I make in my book is that in the existing literature on the political economy of housing, the experience of residents doesn't come across very strongly. Or you could go even further and say the political economy of housing isn't usually theorized or analyzed from the perspective of tenants or from the perspective of antagonism. Which the antagonisms associated with property relations, which would be something that you would very typically see in other areas of political economy. And I think your book does that really effectively. And then like from that starting point, you're able to identify these relations that are property relations, exploitation, but also relations of power and domination. One of the most common types of pushback I get, and I'd be interested to hear if you guys have any reflections on this, is that the type of situation you're talking about, Tracy, isn't a function of the political economy of the private rental sector, but is actually a kind of policy failure. Because in some countries, they have better tenancy arrangements, right? So people typically point to countries like your Germanys or your Denmarks, where tenants' rights are much stronger. And so from that point of view, it becomes more a question of policy failure than political economy. And I struggle to respond to that sometimes. So I'm just going to throw that and see if anybody would like to come in on that. Jacob?
Well, is it policy failure or is it policy success? There's success by the landlord class in certain countries to treat housing as an asset. And it's not an accident. It's not something that countries fell into. It's been, you know, a long-standing project. And it's coming to fruition, not just in the obvious places like the US, but now it is coming to fruition. That their long-term project of treating housing as an asset is coming to fruition in France, in Germany, in countries of Northern Europe where housing was considered more secure. And it is undermining people's right to housing there as well. It's just taking a bit longer.
Yeah, that's a really good way of thinking about it. You're kind of, again, bringing the kind of class politics back in there, but in a different way in terms of seeing how policy itself reflects class politics. I might then ask you, Jaime, because your book also looks a lot at the relationship, property relations, let's say. That's, in a way, that's the point of departure for your analysis of Spain's housing issues. But you focus more so, I think it's fair to say, on what we might call the distribution of ownership of property and the concentration of ownership of property that has happened in recent years. So in a way, you're looking more at a structural set of social relationships, you know, rather than or perhaps in addition to the direct relationship between an individual landlord and a tenant that Tracy has been talking about. So I just wondered if you could talk about that a little.
Yeah. So until the great financial crisis of 2008, many different countries basically tried to extend what we could call homeowner societies, where almost everyone through a mortgage could become the owner of their home. The crisis already began by the early 2000s, but we can agree that since 2008, we entered a new paradigm. So what we're seeing is that those so-called societies of homeowners are being slowly demolished. And it's a very slow process. In some countries, it's much faster. What's happening is that those that already own properties are accumulating more and more. More or less, it's the process that Tracy already like summarized. So what's happening is that those that accrue rents through housing are able or have no other alternative through, you know, so much liquidity than to buy more assets. Part of those assets are basically more homes. So those that traditionally used to become homeowners to buy their first home, their children and their grandchildren are seeing it more and more difficult to fulfill that kind of aspiration, that dream, because they're competing when they go to the market. If they want to purchase a home, if they can try, if they have the savings, they're competing with others who are already in possession of other assets. So they're being outcompeted. So what's happening then is that they become, those that would have become homeowners become the renters of homes that are owned by, you know, multi-proprietors. We call them multi-propietarios, or sometimes much bigger landlords. So what we're seeing is really a big divide. So slowly we're dismantling the kind of agreements, the social agreements that were reached after the Second World War until the 1980s. Some could argue that crisis started in the 80s, but at least you could say in many countries between the Second World War and the late 1990s, you had a model that's now in crisis. We're in a new paradigm, and unless radical changes, very, very different, ambitious changes start taking place, that's just, that division is gonna grow and grow.
Thanks, Jaime. And yeah, I mean, I feel like both me and you, Jaime, came to this conclusion separately in a way that, because I think your book was published before mine, but I had already submitted my manuscript. But you've been writing for some time, thinking about these issues through this lens of the concentration of ownership and seeing, therefore, that the growth of the private rental sector as a form of housing is intrinsically related to inequality. And that inequality works across or manifests through both wealth inequality and then property relations and then social stratification. Kind of in a way, property is playing a role in social stratification that it hasn't before. One of the things, Jacob, I might turn to you for this one. One of the things that Jaime's analysis brings up is this question of generation rent, a generational lens for thinking about this, right? So Jaime has talked about this transition over time. And one of the things that that's kind of notable is that difference in housing experiences between young people today and their parents, for example. It's kind of downward residential mobility. However, there's a lot of people who've been very critical of the generation framing as well. There can be problems with that type of framing. So I'm going to throw that to you, Jacob, but if anybody else wants to come in on that, please do.
Yes, I think the generational framing can be useful in certain concepts. I would say that we don't use it a lot in tenant organizing in the UK. And the reason for that is because we're focused on what unites us. And the generational framing can sometimes seem like a bit of a division. And of course, there are older people in bad housing situations and so on. I think it is, though, a complicated picture. And of course, on average, this generation of young people just have it worse in housing terms than their parents' generation did. So there's something really important happening there, which is to do with the success of the neoliberal project and the rise of rent in the economy. But I think in organizing terms, it can be an awkward one. And sometimes it feels better just to talk about class. And to talk about, for instance, the way the experience of housing can change your class position. Now, this is complicated stuff. Not everyone agrees because they want to focus on class in relation to the workplace. But for me, I think we need to develop quite complex ideas of class now, because people undergo such different processes, because class formation is about the processes people go through. People undergo such different processes in the workplace and now in housing as well. The reason that to me it's more important to talk about that than about generations is that, in fact, there's so many young people today who are at present living in rented accommodation, but who will at some point inherit from their parents. And that's going to give them quite different life experiences, right, over the course of their lifetime. So I think we just have to sort of complicate things a little bit and ask what are the actual processes that people are being subjected to in this housing economy.
Really, yeah. Okay, very nuanced points there, Jacob. Thanks for that. Let's develop this a little bit more. I'm going to put this to you, Tracy, but again, anyone jump in. One way that I sometimes think about this, and it relates to the points just made by Jacob and those made by Jaime, is you can perhaps think about two fundamental cohorts in the private rental sector. On the one hand, you have the cohort that the media are usually concerned about, which is people whose parents were homeowners, but who have not been able to become homeowners themselves. Those people perhaps may feel a sense of being excluded from the social contract, a sense of being unable to begin the adult life they had planned, and so forth. On the other hand, you have cohorts who were never part of that social contract to begin with. So those are people whose parents were not homeowners themselves, either because they rented privately or in public housing, as well as people coming from a migrant background whose parents might have been homeowners, but in some completely other country, which means they don't have access to any kind of wealth or inheritance, or people who don't have that social contract in through their migration as a result of their migration experience. And they might experience other exclusions as well around their citizenship status or their employment rights or whatever. Those are two cohorts that we could think about this kind of question through, Tracy. I don't know if any of that makes sense to you.
Yeah, no, I think that that's a really good analytic. And I think that, you know, you can also think about it from the flip side, which is like, how do you build solidarity across those like different experiences? And I think that, yeah, I mean, I think one of the ways that we have to think about the economy of renting in the private market is that people are subject to forms of heightened exploitation because they are in like what they're in trap economies. Like they've been effectively, I mean, especially in the United States, we have the history of subsidies for white homeowners and abandonment for Black, Brown, and immigrant tenants. And so not only were Black, Brown, and immigrant people excluded from the asset of becoming homeowners and like getting to build wealth, they were also like then, because of that exclusion, then exploited further and taken advantage of in the private rent, it's like, you know, in the private rental sector. And so I think that the legacy of inequality that is completely racialized is the ground on which we're organizing now to think about that history of exclusion and the generations of wealth building that were denied to Black, Brown, and immigrant tenants. And then to, you know, to think about the kind of downwardly mobile populations of cities now as actually having something in common. It's sometimes really difficult for our organizing. But at the same time, I think we see in a given like rent stabilized building in New York that landlords are using different forms of exploitation and attack. And yet it is the same villain doing this work. So whether that's if you're a downwardly mobile tenant and you're subject to illegal rent increases and you're being like exploited for new kinds of fees, or if you're subject to forms of strategic neglect and harassment and displacement. And so I think that our work in tenant organizing is to think about bringing these populations together, bringing them together in a way that refuses the individualized system of wealth building that is actually evacuating a social safety net, right? And thinks about the common enemy, like the common class enemy that is our landlords. Does that make sense? Does that answer the question?
No, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Fascinating, Tracy. Thanks. I don't know. This is quite a, there's probably a lot to say on this topic. So I don't know if Jaime or Jacob, you'd like to come in. Jaime?
Yeah, one of the things about rentierism, I don't know if that's a good translation, it's how I call it in Spanish. So the logics of rentierism, one of the things about it is that it actually, they affect different kinds of populations. So first of all, as you said, Tracy, amongst tenants, there are different kinds of situations, different groups affected in different ways. Usually the most impoverished, the most disadvantaged are those that are made to pay more in relative terms, as we very well know. Predatory forms of renting are especially predominant there. But then you also find, especially in tenants' unions, people who have come to see themselves as so-called middle class, who think of themselves as successful, who are suffering some kind of injustice just because they live in a property that doesn't belong to them. But then you also have other kinds of groups. So for instance, you know, homeowners, just residents who are affected by the growth of short-term rentals or mid-term rentals, which completely deteriorate the social fabric of certain neighborhoods. So in recent demonstrations, not just in Spain, but in other countries, we're seeing, a wide array of social groups, if we can define them as such, coming together. And that's because rentierism is not just a form of rent extraction from specific groups, but from the city, from the country, you know? So it affects groups in terms of impoverishing them, but also in terms of changing their landscapes in ways that are really harmful. The other thing that we were discussing before, which is also very interesting, is the generational issue. I want to comment on that very briefly. I think the so-called generational conflict, or for lack of a better word, actually is a parenthesis. So yes, it's true that most baby boomers in most countries own their home, whereas millennials and Gen Z have it much harder. So a higher proportion are tenants. But as I was saying, this is a historical parenthesis. What we're going to see in 20 years after the great wealth transfer is that we're basically going to have a much bigger class divide. And this is what's coming. We shouldn't talk about generational divide, but about the fact that we're rather facing the end of an era. We want to see the dawn of a new era with much less division. But to stop that, we need a set of policies, not just housing policies, that are going to need to be much braver, much more ambitious than what we've seen so far. And clearly, that's clearly going to come through mobilization, not through benevolence of policymakers. It's going to be very difficult to achieve that through that way.
Okay, really interesting. Thanks all. A lot to think about there, but you raised, Jaime, there towards the end, that question of policy. And so I'd like to talk a little bit about that now, not so much the technicalities of housing policy, but more so the politics of policy. And Tracy, I might go to you again first on this one, because you're quite critical, for example, of the idea of a housing crisis, because you make the argument very effectively that there's always a housing crisis, or that, you know, capitalist housing markets produce these types of inequalities as a matter of course, along the lines of what Jacob was arguing earlier. And the overall impression I get reading your book anyway is that you're quite cynical about policy as a lever or avenue of change. Maybe that's an unfair reading, but I'd be interested to hear your take on that.
No, I appreciate that. I mean, I think it's maybe a better way to like understand how I think about policy is also about its enforcement power, and thinking about this idea that like policy both enshrines and extends class power. And so class power is really reflected in the policies that we have, and then it exacerbates the class dynamics that we have. And similarly, thinking about it from like an organizing perspective, you know, I feel like the struggle for liberation is sometimes instantiated in forms of policy, right? But like that struggle always exceeds what is extracted from that process. And then, you know, just to use like the line that I like is, you know, like could be what I look at in the mirror every day, right? The like the communist auto worker James Boggs, who like rights are what you make and what you take. And the relationship between policy and its enforcement is also something that I think we have to take really seriously when, like, I know, for instance, that in New York City, I'm not supposed to have roaches, leaks, molds. Like, I know what my living conditions under the law are supposed to be. And yet I'm not living with those conditions, and neither are like, you know, 2.3 million of tenants in New York City. For me, the question is about how we can use the like armature of the state in all of its different capacities as a kind of like bag of tools that serve our organizing work and that establish a plateau on which we can organize. And so I also have the experience of having moved to New York, participated in the election of a democratic socialist mayor, Zoran Mamdani, whose top line campaign promise was freeze the rent. And like to be in a political process right now where I've been organizing with the Union of Pinnacle Tenants, which is the largest portfolio tenant union in New York City, and to work with a actually responsive administration is to, like, you know, in some sense, both reevaluate, but also simply like deepen my understanding of what the relationship between organizing and the state is, which is to say that what we do and what we have to do is create the potential for new political possibilities, right? That I don't even expect a democratic socialist administration to socialize housing. What I think is our obligation in the tenant movement in New York is to seize the opportunity of that administration to organize like net portfolios across New York City to make that demand and thus extract that capacity from the state as a reality that then we can live with and like probably have to like reinvent down the line. Coming from the perspective of Los Angeles with like a 13 person city council for a city of like millions of people where it's like this absolute heinous fiefdom to go to a place with like a more response. It does in fact change and it as it should change your relationship to policy and what's possible. Is that I think that maybe the idea is to simply like what I've been doing in some ways is to give up positions of dogmatism that I might have had in the past because we are entering into new political possibilities. And the most, what I think, revolutionary thing that I can do at this minute might be different than what it would be in another context. Ultimately speaking, I think that, you know, we on the left are very we have been very disciplined into forms of victimization as outsiders. And I think that in some ways we've become too complacent with that identity and like have made that an identity as opposed to like situating it in its historical context. And I think right now for me, I'm really interested in thinking about the state as not like one thing. It like that there's a multiplicity of capacities that can be leveraged to our ends, and the ways that tenant organization is where the demands come from, is how we like pull those levers and invent those capacities from the state.
Thank you, Tracy. Okay, yeah, so there's lots there. Jacob, I might ask you to come in because, Tracy is talking about navigating a set of tensions there and thinking about questions of policy, questions of also power, relationships between tenant organizing and institutions. And that stuff comes across very strongly in your book, because you're looking at tenants' movements across a really wide variety of countries and contexts. I think you talked there specifically about how these types of questions arise. So how are they arising in different contexts? And do you have a view about what the correct way of thinking about housing policy is, and the potential of housing policy as a agent of change or an avenue of change?
Yes. I mean, as I say in the book, people's different tenant unions' approaches just often depend on the political landscape in their own country and the range of possibilities that seems available to them. If you have more, more of a tradition of social democratic parties in your country, then you're probably more likely to try and lobby for more sort of immediate changes in the present to policy. I could never say it's not important. In the UK, we've actually just won the biggest change to rental legislation since Thatcher, the biggest improvement to rental legislation. I mean, the headline is the end of no-fault evictions, but it's actually quite a bit more than that, because we've gone from a situation where all tenancies were usually either 6 months or 1 year tenancies, and now we're going to have all tenancies will be in indefinite tenancies. That's a really major change that's going to make a lot of difference to people's lives. I also, of course, just always want to look at policy from the organizing perspective. And something you need in organizing is wins, right? You need to get some wins, or people aren't going to stick around with the organizing. So policy is one way you get wins and you get real improvements to people's lives. The kind of lobbying you do for policy changes is not the kind of thing that can totally alter the housing landscape. And I think we all understand that. And if you want to stop housing being treated as an asset at all, that's not something you're going to get by lobbying the current political parties, right? But the demands you make can be really important for organizing. We've got a national housing demonstration coming up in the UK, and actually it's the biggest demonstration for a long time. And it's united around two demands, right? Rent control and build more social housing. And those two simple demands just make it easier for people to work together, because you may have political differences aside from that. And you may have differences in your ideas about what you want to happen to housing, what your housing utopia, let's say. But those kind of intermediate demands are very, very important for organizing around. And of course, if you win some of them, then you draw people into organizing because they see that you can win.
Jaime, then, this is something you've also written about. I wonder if you'd want to respond to anything we've heard on this topic first. And then I have a follow-up question for you that's related.
I think Jacob and Tracy already did a great summary of the question. I would just add that I think that Jacob's book addresses this. It's very interesting how across different nations and countries, most of the changes that are taking place have to do in one way or another with tenant politics. So new tenant organizations, relatively new or very like super recent, are prefiguring new housing policies. Then regardless of whether these tenant unions actually, you know, have a say in the policies that are passed, or whether these policies are elaborated by a committee of experts, it's very interesting how tenant unions are influencing a lot of like many, many housing policies in different countries. And actually, as I said before, this is just a sign that much more is to come and much more needs to be done. But of course, in this politics, there are other forces within the state and outside of the state. There is clearly in many countries a reaction. Especially the far right is proving to be very successful. In Germany, the far right is actually growing by, you know, appealing to tenant voters, to like, you know, people who are disillusioned and very frustrated with the housing problem. So a lot needs to be done, but this is the new conflict. This is a new class conflict. It wasn't there in this form and shape 20 years ago.
Lindsay, you're wanting to come in there?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I think that that's also really important to think about how the forces of reaction are seizing on the contradictions of housing in this moment. I mean, to make it like absolutely disgustingly clear, the Republican housing platform was mass deportations, right? That was their solution to the so-called housing crisis, was mass deportations and animating their base on the basis of like xenophobia and racism. And similarly, I think that when we think about, you know, the results of like decades long crisis of tenancy, where we have a crisis of mass homelessness, and the way that that crisis is leveraged, you know, in the service of law and order politics that are actually about like defeating the kinds of socialized care that we would need in order to actually solve that crisis. And I think that it's just, I think that it's really important to think about how the crisis of housing and tenancy makes people vulnerable to these kinds of makes people vulnerable to right-wing polarization, and then what our movements are doing to interrupt and intervene that pull.
Michael, you know a lot about this. You've written a lot about it. So you have, like, we could call them the, I don't know how to call them, in the US, it would be probably the Republicans here we call them the liberals, which is the opposite to how you refer to them in the US. So the neoliberals, like the most moderate ones, they talk about supply. So there's a crisis of supply and demand. We just need to solve it by increasing the supply. We call them supply believers here too. And then you have the less moderate, the more reactionary segments, and what they're saying is the problem is demand. There is too much demand. And what tenant politics are doing, and not just tenant unions, other people are doing this too, but clearly what they're doing is to actually show, like, it's a political economy reading, to go back to your first questions, Michael. So actually showing the power relations within housing markets, the class relations, which is what this two poles, like the supply believers and the demand believers, or whatever, are trying to disguise, right?
Great, yeah.
Thank you so much. That is so helpful.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to say on this one, you know, because I think a lot of the housing debate in different countries in the last years has been reasonably favorable to tenants and tenants' movements. I say, you know, reasonably favorable in meaning there's been some openings for tenant organizations to intervene and start to put the case for changing aspects of the housing system. And as you say, Jacob, a lot of the time that comes to things like rent controls or social housing or different forms of decommodification, essentially. But I have the strong sense now that we are seeing the beginning, and we'll see more politicization of housing from the right. And I think that there's a real danger here, because housing sits at the intersection of a number of different things, which are structural features of our current political economy, but which are also highly emotive and mobilizing things. So housing is really, so first of all, from a political economy point of view, in housing, demand can increase quicker than supply. So we all, in all of our books, we talk about the idiosyncratic or specific features of land and land markets and how they generate problems in housing and housing supply and housing affordability and housing justice. But one of the realities of the nature of land markets and housing markets is that the supply can be inelastic or unresponsive. And demand, for not just because of migration, for different reasons, can increase more quickly. But also then housing touches on questions of belonging and ultimately the nation, right? And Jaime, you alluded to this already when you talked about the role of home ownership in the social contract. And in countries, certainly countries like Ireland and Spain, home ownership was really clearly linked to national projects. In the Irish case, in authoritarian regimes in the middle of the 20th century, and in Spain's case under Franco, and a little bit different in the US and the UK, but not totally different, because you had those ideas of the property owning democracy and so forth. And then finally, housing links to fertility and children and families, which again are not necessarily right-coded issues, right? But the right is increasingly obsessed with the politics of the nation as a biological entity that needs to reproduce itself in the face of biological threats from migrants and low fertility. I'm quite concerned about what can happen there. And I do think it's going to be quite challenging for tenants' movements to navigate, partially because of some of those class differences within tenants, right? Between people who can see a path to home ownership, for example, and those who can't, between people who feel they have a right to belong in the nation because of where they come from, who their parents are, or their color of their skin, their migration status, and people who don't, and so forth. So I don't know if anybody wants to come back on any of that.
Yeah, what we're hearing from far-right parties in the UK is becoming sort of increasingly toxic, with developing ideas around sort of mass deportation that were simply not around a few years ago, that was not being talked about. So it's quite a scary moment. And certainly some of that is focused around the housing issue. And in particular in this country, because there is still a lot of council housing left, the question of who gets council housing is raised a lot by the far right. Now, council housing is given according to need, and relatively often that means that people from migrant backgrounds do get some council housing. So, of course, that becomes something that the far right points at and says they're taking your housing. This is just something that has to be addressed through organizing, from my point of view. You have to organize with people. And when they say to you, oh, I can't get a council house because an immigrant took it, you have to say, or can you not get a council house because they sold off all the council housing, you know? And isn't it a choice that there isn't enough housing for everyone, enough public housing for everyone? We're in this scary moment, and I don't see another way of addressing it besides organizing, getting people on board with an idea of solidarity that cuts across the divisions that the far right are trying to stir up.
Thanks, Jacob. I do want to get back to the question about the politics of policy, and we can return to some of these issues, of course, later. We will be talking about tenant politics in more detail in a little while. But, and this is a question for you, Jaime, in particular. So in a way, I want to kind of push back a little bit on the conversation we've been having about the politics of policy thus far. In a way, we've been talking about policy as kind of secondary or almost epiphenomenal, to use a very academic term, to say it, that the real action is the class politics of housing. And then you have policy playing almost this kind of catch-up role with that, right? Whereas in your book, Jaime, so two things there. One is you argue that policy has actually played a decisive role in changing the dynamics of the housing system. So, right, that implies that policy is actually really, really decisive in it's core to how the class relations of property are structured, right? Secondly, a lot of the good old days of housing policy that you talk about were under a fascist regime. So they weren't exactly the outcome of working class organizing, right? On the contrary, they were the outcome of the, you know, one of the worst defeats of working class politics in the 20th century. And then finally, in the conclusion of your book, you emphasize different, you talk specifically about Vienna and Singapore, but you do put a lot of emphasis on the potential of policy to produce a different type of housing system.
Yeah, well, there's a lot there. So you were alluding to Francoism, right, in Spain, but we have other examples of governments, countries across the world with, you know, dictatorships that also like did things that were not what social or socialist democrat governments were doing after the Second World War, but all of them were led by the idea that the state had to provide housing for all. This was, I mean, to different degrees, there was a sort of consensus after the Second World War, progressively in many different countries, that governments have to do this, very often not out of benevolence, but in fact to stop the possibility of rebellion, bourgeois reformists since the 19th century had been talking about the barracks of socialism when they talked about, you know, the shanties growing in the peripheries of cities with their industrialization. So it's interesting, however, so if you look at the UK, in the book, I actually talk a lot about Nye Beavan, the first, so-called housing, important housing minister, not just housing, health too. Maybe Jacob can say more about this. I'm a bit embarrassed to be the one talking about it because I'm not an expert, but actually I've read a lot about him and about the politics of that time. And that kind of ideal was very strong in the UK, which is why, you know, England managed to have, you know, 40% of the housing stock within a public system outside of the market. But then you also have countries like Spain, which tried to do something similar. The key was that the state really had to become an entrepreneurial state in the sense that it would actually create that public-private housing system where the vast majority of the population would have that right guaranteed or insured. And that was the role of the state. And actually, in many of our countries, until the 80s, most of the housing produced was produced by the government. It's really intriguing. Then since the 80s, we know we entered a completely different paradigm. And I feel now we are at a point where that paradigm is in crisis. And I'm talking about, you know it very well. The model was that, you know, the market would provide, not the state, not the government, and that the public housing system had to be dismantled. And now we are at a point of crisis. So for instance, in the EU, there's a big battle inside the EU Parliament and the European Commission. This is also happening in the United States. Some think that we need a state, governments that become involved in similar ways to the past in the provision of housing. Others think that the government just needs to help market actors provide the housing through public-private arrangements. We're at a time where there are different ways of thinking of how to get out of this crisis. And maybe we can talk about that. Maybe I deviated a little bit from your question, Michael. But this is a big issue, by the way, because most of tenant politics have focused on decommodifying, especially through regulations and interventions in the market. So Jacob mentioned indefinite contracts, agreements in the UK. In Spain, there is a new housing law since 2023, which allows regions to cap the price of rents. In Catalonia, in Barcelona, 80% of the rental market is completely regulated now. There's been a lot of that and very little in terms of public provision of housing, very, very little, which we know that in the past was actually the way or the main avenue for addressing the housing problem.
Yes, that's really, really, really interesting, Jaime. I think you're quite right. Yeah, there's the kind of politics around the regulation of the private rental sector, which is in a way kind of defensive, if you like, or kind of reactive. And then you have this other set of questions around expanding the role of non-market housing, essentially. To just turn a little bit to this question of tenants as subject. So, right, the idea of, and this is really core, I think, to contemporary tenant politics. And I think, Jacob, you argue in your book that this is, you know, kind of a common way of thinking about organizing across the different examples you look at. And it features very strongly in your book as well, Tracy, the idea that the function of organizing is to create, to construct tenants as a political subject. Jacob, what do you think is, I suppose, meant by that? Or how do you think about those types of issues based on your own organizing, I suppose, but also what your research for the book?
Yes, I mean, tenant organizing tries to create a new collective subject, but it does start with what is forced upon you, you know, with the experiences that the housing market forces upon you. And that is, of course, being essentially a cash cow for people richer than you. It's the most obvious one. But it goes a bit beyond that, I would say. A very common experience of tenants is being treated with contempt by their landlords. And this is also, I should say, one of the reasons why, let's say, people from more middle-class backgrounds also find the rental sector quite shocking sometimes, is that they're less used to being treated like that. And suddenly they're in some aggressive rental market and the landlords can do what they want. So there are these things that are forced upon us, right? The point of organizing is you point out the commonalities to people. You focus on what people have in common, but then you try and develop a collective subject that has strength, that from those like wounds that the rental market is inflicting on you, you build an identity that enables you to gather strength. It does feel slightly different in different countries, I think, sometimes, and that's partly because things like people's sort of self-perception of class can be different in different countries and so on. What becomes important actually is acting together. And you can't develop a sort of collective subject without acting together. That's kind of the core of organizing, right? People in reacting to what is being inflicted on them learn to act together. And it is through that collective action that they become someone slightly different than who they were before. I think that is quite a novel experience for a lot of people in countries of the global north right now, because I talk about this a bit in Renters Unite. Like, we came out of a period where sort of left-wing organizing was an all-time low, really. Things have changed so much when I was younger, and thank goodness in a certain way, because when I was younger, almost nobody I knew was involved in any left-wing organizing of any sort. And they never had that experience of building solidarity together with other people. And I think this is a really key part of how tenant organizing is sort of changing the political landscape, is like people getting this chance to experience solidarity together with others and change themselves as individuals, changing in the process.
That's really interesting, Jacob. But yeah, and one of the things I've found fascinating about following the tenants organizing for the last nearly 10 years now, I suppose, is what's coincided with the growth of tenant activism has been a growing interest in what we might call organizer type models. And it just seems that the two things happened at the same time. Coincidentally, like, housing issues became a really big issue for a lot of people at the same time as a lot of activists were growing disillusioned with maybe some other older forms of activism or that they had relied on and getting interested in this organizer model. And a lot of that has been kind of imported to a degree from the US, because it seemed, my perception is the organizer model was originally developed and more prominent in the US, or I don't know how far that goes back, but in places like Spain, certainly, and most of continental Europe, up until relatively recent, most housing politics was quite what people would often describe as anti-systemic. A lot of it was about squatting. There was an emphasis on autonomy, very little interest in engaging with the state, and very little interest in organizing, and sometimes quite, I suppose, ideological, quite countercultural, and so forth. Whereas in places like the UK and Ireland, probably housing politics was maybe a little bit more dominated by socialist parties, and to some degree was often very strongly linked to social housing stuff, and often social housing estates were really the kind of the last places where there was some interest in kind of housing politics and community politics. Yeah, so it's been really interesting to see that. And a lot of the organizations out there have adopted a union type model, by which I mean with fee paying members. I think in the book you say that at the time you wrote the book, that London Renters Union has had 15 employees there or something, which seems like a lot to me, you know. So yeah, I mean, that's just an observation, that it's been interesting to see those two things. And I guess from a kind of a more academic type perspective, there's an interesting question here, because part of creating tenants as a subject relates to language and discourse and types of analysis, right? Like through which everyday experiences and forms of antagonism are expressed in language, right? That's part of how identities are produced, or senses of shared subjectivity, etc. But a lot of that language, or to some degree that language, comes from social science or academic theory and political economy. It's reasonably common to find tenant organizers who are also housing researchers who are working within a political economy perspective. So it was this kind of a weird overlap where, you know, organizers can use political economy frames as part of this, which is then being, you know, studied by housing researchers as an object of research as well. But I suppose, just to draw out that that kind of connection. I don't know if anybody else wants to come in on this kind of question of tenants as subjects. Tracy.
Yeah, I mean, maybe just to push back a little. I mean, I have this sort of like Kwame Ture line in my head, which is like, Marx didn't invent communism. He noticed it. He didn't invent capitalism. He noticed it. And that is that idea that I think is actually like really present in the everyday lives of tenants, is to notice their exploitation and domination in the housing system that we're in. And I think for me, it's like the role of the organizer is to be a kind of archive of certain strategies and certain, like, you know, to echo something that Jacob was saying, like about producing collective action or the will to collective action that then can be reflected in collective subjectivity and analysis. The experience of exploitation and domination are like really familiar to people, but the strategies to like challenge it even a little bit or overcome it are actually like pretty remote. And I think that it's like in doing that dance between like people's actual deep knowledge of how fucked up everything is, plus, you know, some archive of past movement successes, plus some like, you know, willingness to experiment and be like humble enough to realize that if we had solved the problem, we wouldn't be living in this heinous world that we were living in. And like to think about that kind of like alchemy that is created out of those things. That like subject making is like all of our work. You know, it's like everyone's responsibility to participate in that project in whatever language works. You know, at least in the Los Angeles Tenant Union, it had to be a bilingual union, because that's like part of who's, that's like what tenants are like. The majority of tenants in Los Angeles don't speak English as their language at home, right? And so like, just to think about like language from a more like, how do we engage people to think about the way they're, to analyze their lives and ask questions that like, you know, deepen their relationship to their lives. But then literally just like, if you're only speaking in English, like you're missing the population. Those are just some of the things that came to mind off the bat. Any excuse to remind ourselves that what we're doing is noticing it, is we're noticing a common problem, right? That other, like, that has come before us, and that is the experience of like, of everyone. And then what, and then it's our job to sort of move that analysis in a liberatory direction.
On that very topic then, Tracy, maybe a last theme to discuss is that question of that, as you put it, that liberatory direction, and what does that look like? Jaime, you mentioned it earlier, maybe the question of what, I don't really like to talk about solutions. Here in Ireland, where I'm based, there's a lot of discussion about what is the solution to the housing crisis. And I've always find that very frustrating, because it's kind of like, it's a very technocratic framing, right? As if there's just a part of the machine is broken and we just need to identify which parts it is. And once we go in and tinker with that, the machine will go back to functioning as it's intended to, which is, you know, that we'd all live in mansions. What does progress from a housing justice point of view, or what does transformation look like? So I'll throw that open to anyone who fancies taking it on. Hey, Tracy.
I can just start. And then that, which is easier for me, because then I just say whatever off the top, and then I can leave the like actual depth to other people. But I really agree with your distrust in the framing of solutions. And I think that one of the things that I'm thinking about now is like, what are the particular strategies that we have through tenant organization that displace the power of landlords? And in my mind, right, like those, we are working with two tools. Like one is collective bargaining, this idea that we can extract concessions that put more of our resources back into our homes by organizing, that in that way we have more democratic control over the rents that are stolen from us every month. And so we can extract, we can claim more democratic control over those resources through tenant organization at the like building scale, and like going through a process of demanding negotiating rights and like thus reclaiming those resources. The other side to that, that displaces the power of landlords, is to like move through a process of actually challenging the ownership relations, right? Like, what are the places where landlords are becoming vulnerable to losing their land? And we're seeing this actually a lot in the context of New York City and rent-stabilized housing, because the massive over-investment and over-speculation in this housing, that landlords have taken on such insane amounts of debt that they can't pay their own stupid bills, and they are going under. And I think that, like, you know, this is a moment of crisis where, of course, landlords will come with their solution, which is that regulations have made them bankrupt, and like, you know, they need more state subsidies to like, you know, run their businesses. But, you know, from the tenant organizing perspective, like, we have to be ready to say that landlords who make tenants miserable and like make the city less affordable shouldn't have business in the first place. And so like, what are the tools that are available to us at this moment, whether that's forms of like community ownership? Sometimes people overemphasize community land trusts, but I do think that part of like removing land from the speculative market, and then thinking about how can we build up state capacity to actually do that work, right? Like New York City, like I'm just speak from my own context. It's like, New York City is desperate to not own any housing. That has been their practice for the last, like, however many decades. However, the ultimate solution is to this crisis is to build back up that state capacity, whether that's through like a land bank or new ownership pipelines or expanding the capacity of the public housing that we have. Like, the movement makes those demands. And in this moment, we make those demands to like extract those capacities to make that reality possible. You read in the book a kind of like messianic vision for like the abolition of rent, which I like am fundamentally committed to. Like, that is a lifelong struggle for people in generations after me to pick up. And at this moment, using that vision as a criteria for what I'm doing now is about advancing those two strategies that I just named.
Fascinating. So Tracy, thank you. You said you were going to go for the low hanging fruit, but you didn't really live up to that then. Jaime, I'd be interested to hear your take. You're probably the closest thing to a wonk in what Tracy described. Do you know that? I don't know if you know that term, a policy
you
wonk.
Do, I do.
Yeah, I'm actually a policy wonk as well. Yeah, I'm ashamed to say I'm a policy wonk too, secretly.
Yeah, actually, I'm not uncomfortable playing with the dominant terms like the housing crisis. Housing is in crisis, because housing has been turned into an asset. And I'm not also uncomfortable talking about solutions. The thing is, what kinds of solutions do we come up with? But to come up with solutions, we need to frame the problem correctly. So when we say that housing has become an asset, we need to explain what are the drivers that are actually boosting, inflating the price of this asset. My argument is that there are mainly two sources. One of them is banking. So financialization, as it's been understood over the last 15 years, as long as housing continues to be a very profitable, a fundamental asset for the banking sector, there are going to be these inflationary dynamics in housing systems. As long as it's very profitable for banks to lend to working class families, this we know, we don't have the time here, but we know it has inflationary effects. That's one source. That's one part of the problem. The other part is like, so, okay, wealthy people can either lend you the money and then they make rent out of your interest rates by you paying them interest, or they can directly own the housing, which is what's happening in many places. So buy the housing, the buildings, and then turn them either into normal rents or, you know, short-term, especially, that's what's the most attractive. Actually, what we're saying is that an increasing part of market actors in many countries, just they don't want tenants anymore. They don't like tenants. They don't like long-term residents. They need the asset to be as liquid as possible. You know, they need rotation. It's a very strong push by asset managers, by other actors. They're very invested in this. And if we don't stop those two kinds of investment, short-term investments looking for very high profits, it's going to be very, very difficult to change anything. So, for instance, we have cities and regions, also countries banning, you know, we're seeing in Canada, New Zealand, the Netherlands, the ban on short-term investor purchases, or sometimes it's just a ban on foreign purchases. But this is, as I was saying, this is just part of the problem. You need a cohesive kind of and coherent kind of approach. And the banking aspect is the most complicated one for me, in my opinion. I mean, because this is part of the change that started in the late 80s. As long as housing is a key form of business for banks, it's going to be very difficult to stop housing from being an asset. And having said that, so these are the two negative forms of investment, like with inflationary effects. But then we do need to think of how to take housing out of, as Tracy said, the speculative market. So there are many ways of doing that. First, we need very strong governments with a lot of capital, but, you know, public capital, to actually not just build, as it's often said, but to acquire. So to buy, to take housing out of the market. This has been, the local government in Berlin has done this a lot very intensively. In Barcelona too, we have other examples. You could probably name a few. But then we also need governments to intervene in the market when homes are bought, sold and bought. So, and I'm going to finish here. One of the things we've managed the government to do in Barcelona and Catalonia very recently is that the government can help you buy a flat by either, you know, tax cuts or a form of aid. But here it is. The difference with other kinds of support from the past is that here, if the government helps you buy that specific apartment, that flat, then in the future, you can never sell it for a higher price plus inflation. So I'm helping you become a homeowner and have that security. Okay, you have to pay your mortgage. Let's not forget that. But I'm also turning those housing units into protected, like non-speculative kind of housing. So we need these kinds of strategies, because what we're being constantly told that governments just need to build a lot of housing as a magical solution is not gonna work. We need to do something with these housing systems that are already in place. This is not the early 20th century. We're in a different situation now. We need to deal with all of the housing that it's not just in the private rental market. It's also just generally in the housing market that is under these crazy pressures to make it a profitable asset. And then, you know, gradually take many of these housing units out of this market and into either public systems or let's call them regulated markets or decommodified or partially decommodified markets. But all of the, for that to work, you need a vast array of policies working in that direction with a lot of strength and for a long, very, very long period.
Thanks, Jaime. Okay, that was a situating of different approaches in a context and then a kind of dissection of what those different approaches involve. Jacob, would you like to come in?
Yeah, well, I want to build on that really and start with talking about the fact that, you know, I'm in a country where housing problems were more or less solved if you go back to the 1970s, right? You had this situation in this country where a young person might leave their parental home and within 2 months they could be assigned a council flat, or they might choose to go and live in the private rented sector and pay about 10% of their income. So people look back to that and think, well, we want that again. It's really important, I think, to situate that in a particular time and say, well, there was a huge ecosystem of left-wing organizing that led to that situation. And in fact, you know, often housing campaigning was not always the strongest campaigning in this country. Of course, it was the labor movement really that brought about the big changes in housing, although they changed the political landscape so much that in fact, a lot of the housing in this country was built by right-wing Tory governments. So there was a huge ecosystem of left-wing organizing. And it's clear to me that we need to do something like that again. But we are in a different situation. I sometimes feel a bit sad that people just feel nostalgic for the 70s housing situation in this country, and they just want to recreate that. I think it's probably not quite going to work like that. And part of the reason is what Jaime is talking about, which is that we are in this economy where rent extraction from assets has become a hugely important part of the economy. And so any left-wing ecosystem that we build has to be quite focused on fighting that sort of asset-based power and really focused on like draining the power and the finances out of those asset markets. And we're looking wider than housing as well. Realistically, we're talking about, you know, public services that have become assets and so on as well. And then creating a form of the state that can move those assets and treat them not as assets anymore, treat them as simply things that we need to live and move them into a place where they are not accessible to capital. Now, I don't think we quite know what that looks like yet. There are a bunch of sort of policies you can talk about, but I think we also need to understand that whatever moves we make as housing movements, the capital will make counter moves, right? Once they begin to understand that their assets are threatened, they will go for some really crushing counter moves, right? Up to and including installing fascist governments to try and undermine it, right? We know this is what happens when capital gets threatened, and we can see the political landscape forming that will allow it. We've got a really difficult task of like building new left-wing ecosystems that have real power and that can fight off these counterattacks from capital as well. And I think they need to create, as they go, new ways of thinking about housing and thinking about the ownership of housing. It's quite a complicated picture, and I'd say that not to discourage people, but just to say in reality there's a lot that has to be built here. It feels sometimes like we're still just at the beginning of the journey. We don't necessarily know what ownership forms that might emerge by the end, but I think it's got to come out of a whole ecosystem of organizing.
Right, yeah. So that's really, really interesting. Listening to those, you know, those three interventions together, I think is really, really helpful. And because on the one hand, you get this sense that there's loads of different ways, you know, there's loads of policies that we already know about. And on the other hand, you get this sense, particularly from Jacob, that there's something we don't really know yet what it looks like. So it's kind of a strange situation because we do know a lot about what makes housing markets work well, or housing systems work well, but there's also aspects of our current, especially when you bring in that political economy approach, the rentierism and so forth, there's aspects that are more novel and more complex. A couple of points that I'd make on those issues. I mean, first of all, I think one thing, Jaime, in a way you're focusing on housing demand in the sense of investor demand, right? So that what's driving house prices and making housing so volatile is the intensity of investor demand.
The kind of demand too, the kind of investment. Yeah, we used to have kind of more patient capital that looked for much smaller returns. Back in the day when Jacob was referring to, when then housing was 10% of your income. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yes, okay. So it's the nature and intensity of demand, which there's different ways of thinking about that. And I personally think that hasn't been super well understood, right? So like, why is there so much demand? And one of the things that's been really noticeable in the last years is that mortgage credit hasn't grown very strongly in most countries, but house prices have grown very rapidly, which is quite surprising, right? And you know, there's different debates about that. But also there is an argument that tends to come from more mainstream economists that in advanced economies, you have a lot of older households with high levels of savings. And that leads to a lot of money in the financial system. And a lot of that demand then, it doesn't have any outlet in the productive economy. It goes into things like housing. But from the point of view of quote unquote solutions, I think taxation becomes important there. And it's maybe something we don't talk about enough. Because one of the reasons why there's a lot of demand for housing is because it's the most tax efficient investment for households in particular. So people are buying housing, not just thinking about the use that they'll get from housing, but also thinking about the wealth that they'll be able to accumulate through owning housing. And a crucial fact of thinking about that is the fact that it is subject to much lower levels of taxation than most other forms of asset in most countries. So certainly in Ireland, it is by far the most efficient way to save is to get the most expensive house that you can get at an as early as possible in your life. So taxation may be something that should be a bigger part of the conversation. I think as well, labor market inequality is something that we maybe haven't, there hasn't been enough connection between analysis of housing inequality and analysis of labor market inequality. And particularly, I mean, the split between relatively high earning, highly qualified people and low paid, low skilled, precarious part-time work. And that split in the labor market, that more polarized labor market, is more and more common in the global north. You know, what that leads to is you essentially have one section of workers or income earners are pushing house prices and rents further and further away from what the other section can afford. Whereas if you have a less unequal labor market, I think that kind of pressure is less intense. And that's probably why cities like San Francisco, for example, which have some of the best paying jobs in the world, have the worst housing markets or the most unaffordable housing markets in the world. But the final point I'll make is, on the one hand, you can argue that it's very hard to make radical changes in housing because of the structural role the housing system plays in economies. But on the other hand, the history of the 20th century shows that landlords are not very effective at advocating for their respectives, right? Because almost every country in the Western world virtually regulated the private rental sector out of existence in the 20th century. I mean, there was extremely rigid rent controls to the point that it became uneconomic to be a landlord. In almost all of Western and Northern Europe, and in many parts of the US as well. And that point, you know, that suggests to me that landlords are maybe a less powerful adversary than we sometimes think. And I think that's, and like, they're not particularly popular among the public. You see it particularly now with the case of institutional investors, which many countries are now starting to regulate, even in the US. With the present administration in the US, there's a move to regulate institutional investment in rental housing. And I think that might partially be the result that, you know, there's a number of things there. One is private rental housing is not very popular. It's not many households aspire to live in private rental housing for life, right? So it's not a very popular form of housing, which makes landlords not a very popular type of housing provider. It's also not very clear what the actual purpose of landlords is. And this is an argument we also all make in our books, which is that what is the actual social function of landlordism? It's not very clear. And that makes it quite easy, I think, to make, maybe not easy, but there's an opening there to make critical arguments. The only real point of having a private rental sector, as far as I can see, is that it has low barriers to entry and exit. So your private rental housing is a good form of housing for someone who wants to find somewhere quick and they don't particularly plan on staying there a long time. Whereas social housing is something that's usually there's a waiting list to access, and home ownership, it's a lot of complication and transaction costs to enter and to exit. So from that point of view, there's some kind of benefit to private rental housing. But once private rental housing goes beyond that function within the housing system, and it obviously has gone far beyond that in our countries, there basically is no real point to it. And I think that, yeah, I think that's a relevant consideration.
I think that's a great slogan for tenant unions. There's no point in landlords. I think we should say that more often.
Brilliant. Well, look, thanks, everybody. It was a fascinating conversation. I hope people find it informative and useful. And I would encourage everyone to check out our books, Abolish Rent, Renters Unite, Beyond Generation Rent, and El Secuestro de la Vivienda. Links will be in the show notes. So thanks a million to Tracy Rosenthal, Jacob Stringer, Jaime Palomera, and from me, Michael Byrne. Thank you and goodbye.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.